Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
Okay, you ready to zoom? This is John Williams. Here comes another exciting edition of the Mincing Rascals podcast. Record remotely over laptop computers with some of your friends, the Mincing Rascals. It's a little jumpy in places. Bear with us, but I think you're going to enjoy this week's edition, which is longer than a J.B. Pritzker press conference, but way shorter than a Donald Trump press conference. All brought to you by our friends at the Joint Relief Institute. If you're listening to this and your knee hurts, I want you to go to the Joint Relief Institute, and I want you to take care of that knee pain. Get a socially distanced walk-in pain-free. They're open. They're safe. They're an essential service. They take your insurance, and the first visit is free. They have two locations. The Joint Relief Institute is in Orland Park, and they're also in Oak Brook. They use digital imaging. They see, you will too if you like, exactly where the tissue in your knees deteriorated, and then they painlessly put a lubricant into that spot, and I'm telling you, it works. So if you've got some free time, and if you're in any kind of knee pain, this is the time to visit jointreliefinstitute.com or call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. Okay. The Rascals are so appreciative that you're listening, hopefully sharing it with your friends. Give us as good a rating as you can. And if you have a question or comment, just email John Williams at WGNradio.com. We're still here. Today is Thursday, April 16th, 2020. It's 1:43 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals, the podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio in Chicago. Actually, the offices of WGN. I'm in my office, and Mincing Rascals are scattered all about.
I'm Austin Bird, Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter.
I'm Eric Zorn, the all-powerful columnist for the Chicago Tribune. My power will not be questioned.
It's absolute power.
It's absolute power.
Yeah, we could start there. It's a little wonky. It's a states' rights issue, but the president has said he has absolute power.
When somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total, and that's the way it's got to be.
Then backed off of it.
I will then be authorizing each individual governor of each individual state to implement a reopening and a very powerful reopening plan of their state at a time and in a manner as most appropriate.
Everybody knows he does not have that kind of control over the states, Eric.
Everybody does know that. And I'm not sure. I think it is part of his view of himself as almost a monarch. And he feels like he can impose his will on the states. And it sounded like he was willing to go the extortion route if they didn't go along with him.
Well, if some states refuse to open, I would like to see that person run for election.
But it's not clear to me right now what it is that he wants the states to do exactly, or whether if even what he says would be effective. Like, let's say that he says, okay, I want baseball to start. Like, let's say he pretends to have that power. I want the Cubs to go play in Wrigley Field. What percentage of us are really going to go out and sit shoulder to shoulder with strangers in Wrigley Field right now under all the circumstances? I think a very small percentage. So it's almost kind of not up to him. He can give states the guidance, but we really need to listen to what the scientists, the doctors are saying about this.
Oh, I just feel like it's all bluster. He had to pull back. He knows that it's unconstitutional to try and override these state restrictions, to override these governor imposed restrictions. And so he's trying to come at it another way, saying, well, I'm still the decider. I'm still trying to exert my authority here by saying that I will outline the guidelines here and I'm pulling all these people together and we will have these things in place. I don't think it means anything. Yes, people will decide on their own. It'll be a slow return to whatever the new normal is.
I'm just pulling up the 10th Amendment. Has anybody memorized it?
I've been talking to people about it all week.
Doesn't it basically say that the powers that are not enumerated in the Constitution are reserved to the states?
Is
that
yes. Thank you, Eric. I knew you'd be good at that.
I thought it said that the president can reopen baseball whenever he wants.
But that's a bad example because baseball is the most complicated. 40,000 people at Wrigley Field is the very worst case and hardest scenario. But can you allow social distancing in restaurants, or can you allow offices that deem it safe to reopen? And I still don't know how the president imagines that he has authority over that. And the question they have not asked him, maybe have not had the opportunity to ask him at these press briefings, is, sir, on what authority do you imagine you are saying you have absolute right over these states?
He's been asked that. Yeah, he's definitely been asked that. And he says, I'll get you the paperwork. I'll get you the white paper on that. And said it repeatedly at that press conference.
I missed Tuesday's press conference because after Monday's, I decided it was not the press conferences were more unhealthy to me than the threat of the virus. Monday's was the strangest damn thing ever. And that's the one where they trotted out the first of what appears to now be a series of videos.
We have a few clips that we're just going to put up. We could turn the lights a little bit lower. I think you'll find them interesting.
Well, we've asked them to accelerate whatever they're doing in terms of a vaccine.
The clip parade. Yeah, I'm just imagining now, to Lisa's point, somebody asking Trump, you know, for what his authority is. And he says, yeah, I'll get you a white paper on it. And he just hands them a piece of paper with Sharpie that says, I have the authority. I thought the Monday press conference, and I'm not a like a knee jerk response, criticism. That's not my style when talking about the president. I thought it was a low point in his presidency, maybe the low point in his presidency. I thought that press conference was absurd, especially in a time of crisis. They asked him legitimate questions about basically what the federal government was doing in February to prepare for this. And his response was, Joe Biden and the media lied, and you're all liars. I thought it was surreal.
The New York Times story over the weekend clearly got under his skin.
Yeah, that's where he was coming out guns blazing over that piece that kind of laid out sort of a timeline of you know, he was warned by this person, he was warned by that person, you know, kind of going through January that this is going to be bad, and just kept moving. Moving on, you know, there were no restrictions in place until really kind of that last part of January. And I'm still trying to figure out who his big critics were that he is citing over cutting off cutting off travel from China. There were still 40,000 people who traveled between China and the U.S. after that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, in some ways, I don't fault him so much for being a little slow off the mark, because a number of politicians were slow off the mark. And you look at, I mean, people were singing the praises of Andrew Cuomo, and he was, you know, he wasn't jumping on this in early February either. It's like, it was hard to see coming. You know, I think where you can find fault with Trump is not that he was hoping that it would go away, or that he was optimistic. It's just that he's so grossly overstated the optimism and grossly and seemed to just really give it second trip rather than saying, look, we see this coming, we're on it, we don't think you need to do this yet. And maybe that even if that was the wrong decision, I think it's the whole attitude that he's taking toward it, which is that, you know, even into late February, early March, he was telling us, you know, don't worry about it. This is nothing. And that's
where we'll be done with this. And yeah, you're right. Cuomo didn't want to shut the schools, if you recall.
I do.
He was sort of like, I don't think that that's a good move. We'll get through this. Rightly saying that sort of there are a lot of, you know, underprivileged kids who find two, maybe three of their meals through the school system. So I think that that's where, you know, a lot of these leaders' heads are at.
If we can look at what happened today, this week, with these protests in places like North Carolina, Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, right. People are protesting, and I understand where they're coming from. I really do. I you know, I'm lucky enough right now to still have a job. Lisa and I have yet to be sacked by the Tribune when it runs out of money. But you know, I think both of us probably are looking at our checkbooks and bank balances and wondering when that day is going to come. So
yes.
I understand where these people are coming from and why they are anxious and angry about what's going on. Because these are situations that are really ripe for social unrest, and people who can't work, who are being kept home, who a lot of them don't even really see the purpose of it. And this is a really tough situation for people to be in. And I understand where Trump's coming from too, honestly. I understand that he wants to open up the economy and then that he's trying to like trade off whether you've got, you know, whether people are going to die, whether the economy is going to collapse and that's going to cause death. And I mean, I don't think this is an easy situation. I don't think it's ever been easy, and I don't think it's easy now.
I think Eric's nuance is very important, and I think the mistake people have been making is categorizing anyone who mentions the word economy as a mouth-breathing Trump sycophant purveyor of doom, when in fact it's responding to people who are under immense duress, immense suffering. So I spoke to a woman yesterday who was a personal trainer out in the western suburbs, and she applied for unemployment for the first time, and it was this big kind of moral quandary for her. She had never used it before, but she said, you know what, I paid taxes for a while, this is something I'm going to apply for. She still hasn't gotten it yet. She doesn't know when she's going to get it. She's an independent contractor, so she can't even apply in Illinois until May 11th. And Eric mentioned Michigan right now, if you're a 1099 contractor or freelancer, you can apply and get those benefits. And Michigan's in way worse shape than Illinois. They've had 1 million unemployment claims, 1 million. And I think Illinois is around in the 600,000 range, but something around a quarter of the Michigan workforce right now applying for unemployment benefits, which is just mind-boggling.
I do think that, I mean, we're just seeing the beginning of these protests. I don't think that that's the end of it. I don't think that, you know, an order from Trump or the passing of into May is going to change that. I think it's going to get worse as people get more desperate.
I agree with that. I wonder if it wouldn't be better for people to these leaders to say, hey, this is when we're going to look at this. This firm date is when we're going to look at starting to lift some of the restrictions. I'm wondering if that would give people a bit of a breather. I know that some of the criticism, especially in Michigan, was just how what that lockdown order really means and how strict it is. They were getting after people for even being out fishing. And so I think that that's where some of that comes from. You start getting people who are living in sort of smaller areas or they live on acreages and they're sort of used to having a lot of freedom. And so when you're talking about people kind of maybe going out and doing something solitary like that and they're getting the clamp down, I think that's where you start to get people really agitated about, okay, you're infringing on my rights. Just sort of giving people a window at this time, that might provide some relief. They gave a firm date of May 15th, that they are going to start to look to lift the restrictions.
What does that mean to lift restrictions? I think, you know, we're all looking for someone to, you know, open up the netting and release the balloons or something like that. But what could Governor Pritzker say today or Mayor Lightfoot or the president? What could happen today? What could they say that would change what we do? I mean, they could say restaurants can open again, but
yeah,
like I say, are people going to go to restaurants at this point, given all that we've been told about how easily this virus is spreading, how important it is to keep that spread down?
I don't know if people will go, but they certainly could say sort of, okay, we're going to open this up. People can have people in their restaurants from 5 to 7 and just sort of slowly, and you got to wear a mask. They sell a limited number of tickets to some sporting events that are outdoors. I'm not sure. I don't think I would be doing any of those things. It's all really difficult to think about when people are still dying from this. People are still being diagnosed with this. And people need, you know, I told you all before, if somebody in my household, we have to be very, very, very careful. Me being the one that going to the grocery store, I have to take a lot of different steps to make sure I come back in here. And, you know, the least of it is sort of washing hands because I do not want, you know, my loved one to get this thing. I don't think it's insensitive to think about the economy. It's just sort of a, right now I'm lucky enough to still be working as Eric pointed out. And, you know, so I'm sort of more thinking about the health line, but as time goes by, people, you know, money is health, right? You have to have the money to buy food. You have to have the money to get out, to be, you know, to pay for a doctor's appointment. So
some people are coming forward with that. I'll take one for the team. Laura Ingraham did that on Fox News.
Now, we all know that in life, there are inherent risks. It's always a balancing act in life and in politics between freedom and security, liberty and safety.
My message is that let's get back to work. Let's get back to living. Let's be smart about it. And those of us who are 70 plus, we'll take care of ourselves, but don't sacrifice the country.
I think a lot of people are willing to impose that notion on the population in general as well. And I think the president is tempted by that too. That is, yeah, some of you are going to get sick and some of you are going to die. And mm-hmm. lo and behold, there's people signing petitions in Michigan and elsewhere going, okay, I'm in, let's go. Let's roll the dice on that.
We've talked about this before, John. I think even the metaphor came up in one of our previous conversations about snake handling. If this is not just So, you know, Laura Ingraham is not just a snake handler here, where if she gets bitten and dies, we all go, well, you know, she took the chance. This is a situation where disease spreads and people carry it without showing any symptoms. Mm-hmm. So you can say, oh, yeah, I'll go get sick, or I don't care if I get sick. But you may give that to your parents, to the senior citizen you run into. You may give it to the grocery store clerk. It's just not that you can't personally just take one for the team. That's the problem here.
But where's the threshold, Eric? I mean, you're not going to wait until it's zero and 100% safety. We don't do that for the flu or anything else.
Well, I don't think a podcast crew can solve that. I think you actually need like epidemiologists and people who really know this stuff to figure that out. Because the risk is clearly that if we open things up, that we'll all of a sudden we'll have a huge resurgence and the hospitals will be overwhelmed. Right now,
I know that.
We've managed to keep the hospital population to a manageable level. We're not in a medical crisis in that, you know, people they're not dying in the hallways like they were in Italy.
There's only so far you can go on the science angle, though, right? So, like, even if you talk to the best epidemiologists and the best modelers, they're going to tell you what their models say. And then it's on politicians. It's why we have politicians to make decisions based on that information. So I think, like, from the very beginning of this, the meme has been flatten the curve. And the reason being, we don't want to overwhelm the healthcare system. The goal was never eliminate the virus to zero, as John said. So I do think you have to keep both in mind. I don't like this idea of like fake martyrdom of people saying, I'm willing to take one for the team to save the economy. That's not how it should work. And Eric's point about, the social element of this being really important, I think, is an interesting one. In Sweden, they practically have no lockdown whatsoever. But revenue for movie theaters is down 99% because no one's going to the movies. You can't just release the balloon, so to speak. But you could also say something like, hey, it's okay to go to the bookstore now. That might not be so unreasonable.
The New York Times had a really terrific kind of a panel discussion, and it was published Sunday, kind of about this. What is the trade-off? Because there definitely will be a trade-off in all this, right? You can't. It's unavoidable. You can't just keep the doors closed forever. And one of the experts is Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, former mayor's brother. He talked about how one of the things that we as a society could look at is perhaps opening the doors of the schools and the summer camps, because kids tend to have more sort of a favorable outcome if they do in fact contract the virus. And perhaps you sort of start that way and sort of take a look at it that way with, you know, maybe less risk, and then kind of pull back from there, take a look at what it looks like, what the spread looks like, and then go from there. And I didn't think that was the worst idea in the world. I don't want to make little ones sort of the canaries in the coal mines, but we do know that they do have better outcomes.
That's a fascinating notion, Lisa, because kids, while they might be the best adapted to handle it, are also the most vulnerable and the last group you want to march in front of that thing. So Eric is saying, well, we need to rely on scientists and doctors and epidemiologists. And of course we do. But at the end of the day, rubes like you and me are the ones that are going to have to decide. We're as smart as politicians, for God's sake. And so somebody's got to make that call. I don't think we're giving fair attention. I guess I keep saying this every time we all get together, to the non-medical consideration here. Or at least I don't want to ostracize the people that are having that conversation.
Part of the conversation for the little ones needs to be that we actually don't know what the long-term effects of this are. If you catch this when you're 10, I don't know what the effects are when you're 50.
Yeah, Austin's right. I mean, we don't know about, and we also don't, we're not even sure yet whether if you catch this now and you recover. There was a story that I heard, I think it was yesterday, about somebody who had gotten it in early March and had recovered and then got it again and died. So it's not necessarily clear that when after you get sick that your antibodies will protect you, that it may come back. I mean, there's all kinds of things we don't yet know about this. You know, and the idea of risk is an important one. We take risks all the time. We take a risk every time we leave the house anymore. We've always have. There is a risk in having speed limits of 70 miles an hour on most interstates. We could drop the number of deaths dramatically if we lowered it to 35. But we've decided that that's not worth the trade-off. But the problem is right now that it's not clear what the trade-off is. And I think, you know, Laura Ingraham and those guys will be right if they said, well, you know, this is, you know, this is going to be like the flu. People are going to die, but we're not going to shut the – every year we get a flu. Every year it kills tens of thousands of people, and we don't shut the country down because we realize that that's the price we pay for moving around in society and having an economy. The question is here is if we just move around as though nothing's going on, as though it's just a normal flu season, if we're not going to have – didn't they say that if we did that, we could have had up to 2.2 million people dying? So that's the kind of thing we're talking about. It's like there's not an equation that we yet know. So that's
right. And the flu, I mean, we have a flu shot, so that you can't even compare that. To your point, you know, you can't even compare because we're all walking around and susceptible to this thing until there is a you know, a shot, something to inoculate a good portion of the population against it. I don't know what it looks like.
Well, but if Eric Zorn were the governor of Illinois or the president of the United States, I think he's very cautious about this thing. And he would be imposing his own attitude about this on 300 million people or 8 million people or 12 million people. You know, in a perfect world, you have a politician whose disposition or whose mental ability best enables them to sort of capture both ends. Some people are going to be unhappy that we're coming out as quick as we are. Some people are going to be unhappy that we've waited as long as we have. New York has just said that it's going to be another month from today. They've extended the stay-at-home orders for a solid extra month. And everything I'm reading would lead you to conclude that Illinois is going to do the same thing, too.
I think so, too.
And I think that even – and then that's not a firm date, obviously, because we've pushed ours back already. New York's pushed its back. And we'll have to see where we are then and what that means. But I have a hard time believing that something like Lollapalooza is still on the schedule for the summer. Like, who thinks?
I just bought $500 tickets for Lollapalooza.
Yeah, but it was from a guy.
They didn't want to give it up.
They weren't real tickets, so that's the thing.
Yeah, you know, it's just from this guy called Larry Lollapalooza.
I wanted to go back to Governor Pritzker for a second, you guys. So the Department of Employment Security here has evidently not been processing people's checks very quickly, and they haven't been staffed to handle it. And I wonder if it's as fair to blame Governor Pritzker as I think Austin is ready to, when it is true that nobody saw this coming. Now, Eric said last week that if you had the staff in place to handle this to begin with, you would have had too many people in place to begin with. So what's reasonable?
You have to build it like an accordion is the point. And Pritzker said this last week, which I thought was, which is not his fault, but is someone's fault that should be held accountable. He told the media, listen, the Illinois unemployment system was only built to handle the number of unemployed people in the Great Recession. You didn't expect any more. Well, why on earth would you build it that way? Every recession, you lose more jobs than the one before. Why would you build it only for the last, you know, highest mark? That's ridiculous. To the other point, and I think this actually goes back to like, no one's saying you need to set a hard date for when X things are going to need to be reopened. Short of that, you need to tell people and be open about what factors you're going to consider. So in this press release by Pritzker today, he says, you know, we're going to look at reopening our economy. These are the four measures by which the Midwestern governors are going to decide, you know, when that's going to happen. By the same vein, in this problem with IDES, the problem with unemployment insurance, and we're having people call in on a daily basis, dozens of people calling us saying, I can't get my check. There's $0 on this card. What am I going to do? I have to pay bills. You as the governor have a responsibility to say, we're going to have this many people in staffed by this date. We're working on this system and it needs to be very fast. The fact that independent contractors and sole proprietors, hairstylists, plumbers, and people like that can't even apply for benefits until May 11th is unacceptable. When you have fewer people who are unemployed than in Michigan and they already have it up. New York State is a good example. So Cuomo got with Google and Verizon, stood up a brand new platform that's entirely online in 1 week to handle those people. And we're taking 4 weeks in Illinois. And Pritzker's excuse was, well, the federal rules are changing. I can't cross-train workers because of federal rules. Meanwhile, you've got 1,000 people in a call center in New York dealing with this issue. His response to that issue in particular has been very frustrating to me.
I think that's fair. I mean, I think you have to, you know, you have to hold these politicians to account for what they do. It is an unprecedented situation. It's very difficult, but you have to look at, and again, you know, I know Austin's written a whole book about this, which is you look around and you see what's best practices around the country. Who's doing this right, and how can we emulate them? And this is an accelerated version of that same problem. And we're talking, when we talk about the kind of long-term problems that the city faces, which is what Austin's book is about, when you're talking about a short-term situation, you've got to say, okay, are they doing it better than we are in California? Let's do that. Or are they doing it better in New York? Let's do that. But let's not look for excuses. And you know, obviously there are a lot of excuses, but you've got to move quickly on that.
What did you guys make of JB saying, okay, I'll privately buy a plane full of supplies in China and fly it in, and we won't tell the president of the United States about it, because if we do, he might try and steal the stuff or something like that. There's two billionaires fighting in the sandbox, isn't it?
That money is our money, is it?
It's not his money, yeah. It's not a private purchase.
Oh, no. I thought JB was out personally for one of these things. No, that was just the state's money?
State money.
I thought it was state money, yeah.
Oh, my version's better.
Yours is much better. Hey, can I ask you guys how your attitude is changing? I've now in day 36 of being in home confinement, so to speak, and it's starting to wear on me a little bit more than.
Yeah, I'm. We were talking about that before we went on air here. I kind of hit a wall Tuesday. Maybe it was because Austin, I think you made me realize I probably looked at the weather forecast and thought, oh my God, cold and snow. But yeah, I was fine last week because I am walking the alleys. Probably shouldn't share that, and it doesn't sound very good, but I'm walking the alleys to stay away from people. And it was beautiful out, but now that it's cold again, I mean, it's so, I'm just tired of being inside. I'm tired of, you know, looking at these four walls.
That's where I'm at. And it was because of the terrible weather. Yeah. It was, I had to deal with a media firestorm over the weekend. So that's always really, really fun. And then got smacked with snow, and we're in day 30, whatever. I don't even know anymore. So that's been tough. Seeing other people is always best. And it feels like I've had this interesting phenomenon. And I have the same relationship with like exercise, where it's like, oh, this sucks. I don't want to go have another Zoom call with my aunt. Like, who's going to want that, right? And then it always makes you feel better every time.
Yeah, Brenda pointed out to me that you can't as easily get out of a Zoom call as you can going to visit your aunt or having a cocktail party you don't want to go to. You can say I'm busy, but they know you're sitting there in your living room. Right. You could open up your laptop, and every time we do, I feel better about it. I'm not as bothered by the confinement as I am just the fog of the damn thing, that it's just there. I've likened it a little bit. I was writing out the stages of grief and maybe the steps in a dependency program, and I'm wondering where we are. It's in China, it's in Seattle, it's not going to come here, and then, oh, it might come here, and then it's here, but I'll be okay, and then no, I probably won't be okay.
There was that sort of snow day phenomenon for a first week or so, where you're like, oh, this is very new and different, and this is something to tell future generations about, and so on. And also wearing on this, and I don't know how it is in the radio business, but certainly Lisa and I are reading every day a Columbia Journalism Review reports on another newspaper that slashed its staff. The LA Times, which used to be our sister paper, is doing 40 furloughs of 12 weeks each. I mean, those are serious problems, and you know, advertising's drying up, and you know, and there's this, you know, the way our economy is connected, it's very worrisome. And people accuse me of you know, you want to crack down on the economy because you want Trump to fail. It's like, this crackdown on the economy is really threatening to me personally and to people I know and love. That is starting every day to wear on me a little bit more and more.
hanging over all of that is just dealing with this ding-a-ling president whose press briefings you think you should watch, but you don't want to watch. You shouldn't watch him, but then you feel you should watch him. The whole lunacy of the Trump stewardship of this thing is just is as troubling to me in some ways as the damn virus itself. I was wondering, what would it be like if somebody else were president, or we were in a country where there wasn't this much animosity? I know a lot of people didn't like Barack Obama, but I did. I wonder how much easier this would be for me if Barack Obama were president.
So I'm not trying to be a contrarian here, but I ping pong back and forth between, at least with these press conferences, they go on and they spiral into places that are sort of unbelievable. But at least we know, or at least we're hearing what they're saying, and we know it's unvarnished. Whether you want to call it truth or not, we can debate that, but it's unvarnished and it's there. One of the things that's starting to get on my nerves is, as I switch around, is some of these cable stations who are like, we're going to cut away from this, that, or the other thing on these presidential briefings. And they're all political. Listen, all of these briefings from the local to the national, they're all political, okay? Everybody's trying to sort of show that sort of this is good governing, because good governing equals good politics. They're all political at some level. And so to sit and decide as a cable news company, we're going to cut away from this part because we don't think people can deal with it. I see it. It drives me crazy. I am not 5 years old. I can deal. I can make some decisions based on what I'm seeing. Just let me decide. You know, I understand I'm a journalist and it might be sort of a different purview, but that is one of the things that's kind of getting on my nerves in all of this.
No, then switch over to Fox. I mean, it's all programming.
Or C-SPAN, they run it.
That, to me, defends locally all of the affiliates or CNN's right to cut away if they feel that the information is not helpful or if the information is false.
Understood, but we also weren't fact checking when we're sort of find ourselves friendly with whoever is in office. Those fact checks didn't come fast and furious, and I'm not
they
saying
necessary. They previously weren't as
that's
necessary.
Not true. That it's not
you think
true.
That Obama or even Bush spun lies as fast as this guy does, or just
everybody needs to be fact checked. I think that that's absolutely yes. I'm not going to say that they spun lies. That's not where I'm at. But did they need to be fact checked? Yes.
Okay. Well, we don't have a Wayback Machine, so we're just dealing with today. And if you think that the current president is being intentionally or accidentally wrong about stuff consistently, or he's pushing a narrative that is just inane, like you went there for COVID information and you're getting his attitude about judge appointees, then you don't have to run that if you don't want.
I agree. I mean, access to information, you have access to all this stuff. If you go look up, you know, YouTube, you want to watch a Trump press conference, you can. No one's saying you can't. So I agree with the, you know, they can make their own programming decisions. I think the frustration with that stuff, though, as Lisa said, like campaign season is insufferable enough already, not to mention having it, under the auspices of this like really, really serious thing, much more serious than any political campaign. So it all looks petty and all looks stupid and all looks theatrical, even more so than it already is.
It does seem to me there's no reason for all the cable news stations to have to carry these news conferences, that they are on C-SPAN. They are Fox is going to carry it wall to wall. People want to watch it. I guess I'm okay with them making their own programming decisions, as long as they're not. It's not censorship, because it is available through all these other means. Mm. I am finding these things strangely compelling. However, I do watch most of them.
Yeah,
because a lot of news comes out of them. Actually,
yes.
So
what news?
Well, things like when he says he's got absolute power. I mean, that's new. When a president takes that attitude, as he did on Monday. Monday's news conference was just stunning. It was breathtaking in all the things that he was saying and the way he was conducting himself and the way he was dealing with reporters and so on. I mean, it was just astounding.
You know you're a fake. You know that your whole network, the way you cover it, is fake. And most of you, and not all of you, but the people are wise to you. That's why you have a lower approval rating than you've ever had before, times probably three. And when you ask me that question, let me ask you this. Why didn't Biden...
I'm interested in how this is all going to play out as the campaign goes along, because we're probably not going to see these big rallies. We're probably not going to, I would put money now on saying that we're not going to have the political conventions in a conventional fashion, so to speak.
And I think he knows that. I absolutely think that he knows that, and he's taking advantage of this time. Sure. Yeah. And I'm not saying that that's right. I just want to hear it. Even going off on about these judges and appointments. I mean, I want to hear that stuff. I want to know. And I guess maybe it's sort of my line of work, but I want to know where his head's at on this stuff.
Well, I guess I'm imposing my views on the cable audience or the cable management, because I've been turning the press conferences off. As compelling or sadly mm-hmm. entertaining as they can be, I've been turning them off because I feel like, for instance, if he says that I have absolute authority over the states, I thought, no, he doesn't. And you all can bicker about this for 3 days if you want. I don't even know if that's news, because it's wrong. And it'll play itself out, but I don't need to invest myself in that.
Sure. But we are writing about it. I mean, I have to watch it because I want to know what he's saying about Illinois and Chicago. And I do think that sort of some of this sort of writing about it, this fact checking, if we had not known that he said that because they cut away, we wouldn't have been able to fact check that. And we would have not known, you know, sort of whether to report it. What you saw were just a barrage of headlines and news reports about how this is unconstitutional, how he could be taken to court over this. I wrote about it. I talked to a couple of constitutional lawyers. I mean, that to me is part of what we do. And I think that we're better at it now than we were.
Well, and that's it. I'm glad you're watching, because then I don't have to. No, really. I want somebody to pay attention to this thing. There's days I can't do it. For instance, prioritize for me, guys. Maybe Eric, you could go first. How much attention or energy should I give to the president's signature on the stimulus check?
Well, my favorite line came off Twitter for the day was someone saying, if I'd wanted Donald Trump's signature on a check, I would have become a porn star.
Oh!
But no, it's like it's his ego getting in the way. He's actually, apparently it held the checks up for a day or two while they were figuring out how to do this. And I don't know if he thinks that people are so stupid as to think that, as to have their vote change, their opinion change, because his name is on that check. Maybe they are. I don't know.
Well, if
my guy's been done in Illinois all over the place.
Exactly. And that's what I was thinking about. I used to work with this guy who this was his biggest bugaboo of any, like he was a policy wonk guy. And his biggest thing was Rahm's names on every kid's book club, Daley's names on all the capital spending. When Pat Quinn did his big capital project, his name was all over the signs. I hate it. It's terrible.
Remember Rod Blagojevich?
Yes.
Yes, I remember that. Well, even on the signs, I don't know if Lori Lightfoot's put her name on this. I haven't been out at O'Hare lately, so I don't know. But did she put her name on the signs coming into the city? Like, welcome to Chicago, Lori Lightfoot.
I remember Rahm being at the baggage claim all the time. And I do remember when Jazz Fest was on at Millennium Park, they had the DCAS, the Department of Cultural Affairs or whatever, and big Lori Lightfoot behind all the performances and stuff. I hate it. I hate it when they do it. And I hate it when Trump does it. It's your money.
Yeah, it's your money. Exactly. It's an added expense. Just leave a DCase. And I mean, we have some kind of a stamp in this alley back behind our house that has Mayor Daley's name on it, because it sort of has some kind of a permeable cement. And it's like Mayor Daley's, you know, alley project.
No, it is an old political trick. And I think we've even seen it not too long ago with Susana Mendoza send out something at some point or.
So the best example recently was Jesse White put his name on early ballots for the gubernatorial race. And I expect them to do that again this year, because he's the Secretary of State. So you open whatever he sends you, but he can just send it from the desk of Jesse White, and everybody's still going to open it.
Yeah. And you ask them about this. I've written about this in the past, and they say, well, people need to know who to hold accountable. And I think that's just crazy.
You know, I did want to do at some point a kind of shout out to CBS's Paula Reed, who had that press conference on Monday when the president began with the 5-minute video that touted the accomplishments of the administration. It included a scroll timeline of all of the things they've done, closing China, closing Europe, getting face masks into the pipeline, et cetera. But there is a pretty big gap between January and March. And they just ran that through, maybe thinking people wouldn't put two and two together. But Paula Reid did. And then she got a chance to ask him about that.
The argument is that you bought yourself some time. You didn't use it to prepare hospitals. You didn't use it to ramp up testing.
You're so disgraceful. It's so disgraceful the way you say that. Let me just listen. I just went over it.
Or this ramp supposed to make people.
I just went over it.
In an unprecedented crisis.
Nobody thought we should do it. And when I did it.
But what did you do with the time that you bought?
You know
the
we
month
did?
Of February. That,
you know what we did?
Yeah.
What do you do? What do you do when you have no case in the whole United States?
You had cases in February.
You reported it. Zero cases, zero deaths on January 17th.
The entire month of February.
The
video has a complete gap.
On January 30th.
What did your administration do in February with the time that your travel ban bought?
A lot. And in fact, we'll give you a list. What we did, in fact, part of it was up there. We did a lot. Look. You know you're a fake. You know that your whole network, the way you cover it, is fake. And most of you, and not all of you, but the people are wise to you. That's why you have a lower approval rating than you've ever had before, times probably three. And when you ask me that question, let me ask you this. Why did Biden apologize?
It was the rare instance where the president couldn't think and talk fast enough to cut the questioner off.
She took some heat from Kellyanne Conway yesterday about it. Kellyanne Conway tried to shut her down.
Paula, I don't know what's happened to you. Respectfully, I don't know why you've changed and you're in the briefing room screaming at Anthony Fauci and the President of the United States. I frankly think it's unbecoming. But that aside, I'll answer the question about how they're going to help America, which is why I'm here. I think you're here for a different reason, it seems, these days.
Which is just, that's just sort of a way to sort of shut everything down, right? Change the subject. It's just absolutely ridiculous. Nothing's happened to her. It kind of made it sound like, well, you were friendly with us and now you're not friendly anymore. No, she's a good journalist. And I agree. It was one of the better moments.
And Trump's style is as soon as someone begins to ask a question, he will talk over them and answer the question that he wants to answer, or will cut them off so they don't get to the end of their question. And she just kept going at him. And it was beautiful. I just got a note, by the way, that Wisconsin extended its stay-at-home order until Memorial Day.
How about this? Memorial Day.
I thought that Trump's response there was to deflect to Biden and to deflect to who else did he talk about? WHO maybe? And the problem was, yes, was Biden calling shutting down transportation from China xenophobic? Wrong. Absolutely. Has WHO been terrible throughout this entire thing? Yes, absolutely. What was the federal government doing in February when they could have been ramping up testing capacity? And by the way, if you want to reopen the economy now, one of the prerequisites, you need to have that testing up. And if you had started earlier, it would have been easier now.
You know, about the World Health Organization for just a minute, Austin, since we last spoke, we've all been getting even more of an education about it. And I think your criticism last week was pretty good and ahead of mine. But we still need a World Health Organization. And don't you think that the United States should still contribute to, participate in that? I mean, if this thing is going to get us again, it'd be nice to have a WHO out there to try and push it back. I would still give money to them.
Well, your only leverage is your money. So if you don't prove that you can walk away with it, what's going to change? And I think you have to throw the bums out. I mean, the fact that they weren't talking about human-to-human transmission in China till way late, how they were talking about how China was being so open with its access to information when they barred people from the WHO from even going there for 3 weeks, when they were wrong on masks, when they were so disrespectful to Taiwan for shutting down travel. They were wrong on all those counts. And so they need to be held accountable, and mere words isn't going to change them. You got to put your money where your mouth is and take it away.
It sounds to me like you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, though.
Have them change the leadership and then start paying again.
It's probably not the right time. I take Austin's points. I think the WHO has a lot to answer for here. The question is, does withholding money from them now, is that serving Trump's political purposes, or is it actually helping the international health effort against the virus. So that's where I would question the timing of this, not necessarily the act itself, but certainly the timing.
So when they were pointing out the fact that we weren't doing enough in February, Eric, I think you pointed out on Twitter or Facebook or somewhere a thing about what the president's schedule was in February, and he was still golfing and going to rallies and maybe being distracted by the impeachment, he said. A more focused president might have been able to marshal forces more quickly.
Or to have people around him who were focused. This is one of the things that stands out from some of the comments Rahm Emanuel made about sort of, you know, working in a White House, in the Clinton White House, the impeachment charges rolled in. He said that they tried to sort of keep this sort of things walled off. You had people handling sort of the impeachment stuff, and you had everybody else handling the business of the day. I'm not sure whether, you know, the team was disciplined enough, to maybe be keeping a watch. I mean, it could have been, they could have viewed it as a distraction even, you know, to kind of say, hey, there's bigger things going on in the world than this, you know, political thing you're trying to start here, Democrats. That could have been a point.
And anything we want to say about Lori Lightfoot or the city per se before we wrap this up, guys? We talked about the president and the governor a lot.
I've got a couple of things to say. One is I think she dropped the ball, certainly the city dropped the ball with the demolition of a smokestack in Little Village. And that's not a coronavirus story. Well, I guess it is a little bit because of the implications. Yeah. But that was a real misstep by the city. You know, they took away the permitting authority and so on from the alderman, which is probably overall a good thing, but it really backfired here. And then she went off on Joe Ferguson, I think it was on Wednesday, for not having a full report yet in on the Eddie Johnson incident, which again seemed like, why are we obsessing about that story? I was like, I was remembering fondly the days when we could worry about Jussie Smollett and Eddie Johnson and all these little stories, all these little controversies that we could chew on instead of this enormous tragedy that we're dealing with.
She was asked about it. Why aren't these reports coming out more quickly? So I think that she's responding to some of the community concern over how long this stuff takes.
But the Eddie Johnson report was on her. The report about what Eddie Johnson himself did was on her desk pretty much right away. That's why she fired him. I think we're talking about the report about what all the other officers did.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know how they could conduct an investigation like that in a time like this when you've got, you know, every cop has got a lawyer that comes with them and everything. It just seemed like a distraction to me to go off. I mean, like you just say, hey, look, we'll deal with that when we deal with it, rather than to throw Joe Ferguson under the bus. Because I think Joe Ferguson is one of the finer public servants in town. So I was struck by that. But in terms of her handling of the coronavirus stuff, I think she's been spot on for the most part. Her I think we talked about this quite a bit last week, but her all the memes and just her attitude about it, I think she's been pretty good.
Hasn't got a haircut since we visited last.
Yeah, that was not a good move.
That was a mistake.
It's still bad when you're talking about doing a public service announcement saying your roots don't need to be done. We're in a pandemic, you know, and then to sort of be sort of standing really close, chummy with your stylist. I know the stylist was the one who posted the pictures, but it's a bad move. You got to sort of, you know, walk the walk and all this stuff.
I think she needs to get out way more in front on, I said this last week, but city layoffs and city pay freezes. It's going to look really bad when cities and the county have to cut services to balance their budget if they don't take the first step and start having some shared sacrifice. I'm going to have a column, I think, actually in the Tribune next week, an op-ed on McCormick Place and what she might be able to do there. But maybe we can talk about that next week. But I think McCormick Place, the days of it being a massive suck of taxpayer resources to benefit a select few businesses should be over, and we should think about how we can use it for good stuff like hospital beds and other things.
Austin, do you have an opinion about the city police doing these seatbelt safety checks, and what they're really doing is shooing people out of high crime neighborhoods under the guise of coronavirus safety?
Major constitutional concerns there. And I think the ACLU has already spoken out about it. I think that's it's bad. And I think there's already the massive problem of trust in law enforcement. And when you set up kind of these fake stings. This happens already, right? Like cops in those neighborhoods already stop people for silly things like having their taillight out or not having their seatbelt on, and doing it for this purpose, I think it's just a step too far. So I hope that gets reined in.
You know, another oh for the good old days reporting in Chicago would be having some fun with Ed Burks using $500,000 or so out of his political campaign chest to pay his lawyer bills. I mean, that law needs to change, doesn't it?
It really does. It struck me. And also there was a story today about Mike Madigan using his campaign funds for legal work. And it's like, when you donate to a political campaign, you expect that the money is going to advance the career of a politician you believe in, not to keep his sorry ass out of jail. And I understand why politicians want to be able to do it, but I don't understand why the public stands for it. I totally agree. I think it's an outrage.
People were asking about why he spent $500,000 on legal fees, and he said it was to monitor other federal investigations, which is great. What a good gig. Just read, you know, Lisa's reporting and other people's about investigations, get paid $500,000.
Yeah, you could have a subscription
to the
Tribune. I have to jump
because the governor's on. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm going to have to jump because the press conference has started. So,
Well, see, wasn't this fun? All of us just talking about good old-fashioned Chicago problems and not worldwide death and damnation. Oh, for the good old days.
For the good old days.
We'll see you later.
Let's talk about Jussie Smollett some more.
I know. Nah, that's probably a good jumping off point for us anyway, guys. Nice job. It's a pleasure reading you both. And keep up the good work. Let's talk again.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.